historical documents and records. It's not the case. It's the willing of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala that this special spot on this planet is something masterpiece and special because of that journey.
Right.
And then after...
So you're saying that the land upon which the shrine is based upon is as
is blessed and divine. From the beginning, it was the journey of the Prophet Muhammad.
Right.
Then, on the year 83 AH, a group of Arab Ash'arites tried to come and settle in this city. And from that year 83 AH up until now, Qom is famous for being the center and core and the very refuge for Shia, 12ers, for Shia 12ers.
Right.
All dynasties like Buwayhid, Aqyunlu, Qaraqyunlu, Safavid, they were supporting this land in terms of the shrine of Fatima Masuma, and before that, supporting the Shia groups who were settled from Ash'arite here.
Mm-hmm.
So the many Ash'arite fellows were the companions of Ahlul Bayt throughout the history from the time of Imam Baqir, Imam Sadiq, and come down. So 83 was the beginning, and thereafter it was the center. Why? Because it is considered as refuge, as secure and sacred because of some elements. Number one, three gates of heaven will be opened, inshallah, in hereafter from the city of Qom. So this is a refuge. This is blessedness. Number two, the Ash'arite have chosen this land for their living. And they were the supporter of Ahlul Bayt. They were violation and campaign against Amavids, against Abbasids, always, unrest and campaigning was here in this city. This is the second. And third, the Qom is a refuge for those who are helpless, based on their daily life, based on their belief system, based on their religiosity. This is a refuge, a place that you come to become like in Mecca, the city of security.
It's a pilgrimage center.
This is another one. And the last one, this is osh or net or center or core. When you say core, it means something unique, special, because of being the center for the spread of the Islamic teachings, particularly from brief system, which is narrated by Ahlul Bayt, by all scholars who were settled here, and then they moved here and there to different cities, and also nowadays, which is the core for spreading Islamic knowledge all over the world.
And I think one of the great blessings that the existence of this shrine has brought for us, not only in the sense that, as you said, it's the core of the city, but also it provides a sense of peace for all of the people. Even when you pass by a holy place and you just say salam to a lady who had a very high status in the eyes of Allah, that gives you sort of sense of comfort, and to sort of take your kids there and talk about her status and all of the scholars who are buried in that holy shrine. These are all adding to the to the fact that this place is blessed. And I wanted to add this, that one of the other blessings that this shrine has brought for us is that Qom is now the center of the Islamic studies in the whole universe. It's the heart of the Shiite center of the world of Islam. And you see people from so many different walks of life, from so many different countries. When you walk in the streets of Qom, it's a unique blend of people from all over the world who share one belief, you know, and one value, and that's very, very valuable. So thank you very much, dear audience. Inshallah, we're going to go for a short break, and then we will be right back. Stay tuned. Dear brothers and sisters in Islam, welcome back. This is a special program, The Ship of Salvation, a special program prepared for you on the occasion of the demise of Lady Fatima Masuma, salamullahi alayha. Dr. Shamili, welcome back. Thank you very much for taking the time to be in today's show.
Thank you.
We are going to talk in the third section of our program about the fact we actually talked in the previous part a little bit about how the existence of the Holy Shrine is a trig for the fact that we have so many different Islamic seminaries, and even the Haram itself, the Shrine itself, is a center for Islamic dialogue. When you walk inside the Haram, in different corners of the Haram, you see students, you see there are small groups of people who are quietly speaking together, talking together. And another thing that I want to share with our dear audience is that in the basement of the Haram, we have this a sort of university for ladies. And we have different classes of memorizing the Quran, reciting the Quran, family etiquettes, and you name it. So many different interesting knowledges that women come to this holy sanctuary, and they actually empower themselves as Muslim women, and they become more educated in the field of Islamic studies. So let's talk about this, about how it is that this Haram has become sort of an incentive for Qom being the heart of the Shiite center of the world of Islam.
Let me begin from this point. My daughter, my dear daughter, I feel fortunate that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has chosen my family to live near Lady Fatima. And you have felt, you have realized, you have tasted that whenever you are in hardship, even whenever you are not in hardship, you feel gap. You feel empty. You feel something loosened. Okay? You come, you enter from one gate and you exit from the other one. You will be released. Just enough for us to live in a city which has the smell, heavenly smell, of the presence of Lady Fatima. I leave all talks and records from big, big, great scholars. Myself, I'm fortunate, I feel fortunate enough to live beside Lady Fatima. And to go back to your point, it is amazing that Lady Fatima did not come to Qom by her own willing. It was a written invitation from Imam Ali al-Ridha, sallallahu alayhi, on the year 200, mm-hmm. 200 AH. He wrote a letter, invitation letter, and sent it very fast by a person to go very first to Medina and invite Lady Fatima. Why? Because Lady Fatima Masuma was the defender of wilaya, defender of imam. That lady must not be buried in Medina. Mm-hmm. Medina has enough. He has to come in the middle center of Islamic Republic of Iran, the core of Iran. the city of Rome. Why? A light, a shrine, as was enlightened on the night of ascendance by Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa sallam. And Imam Ali al-Ridha invited her sister to come. And she came. She settled only 17 days. Only. And after that, from that day, from that date, it was the spread of centers for seeking knowledge. Very small centers. And then came to the time of Sheikh Abdul Karim Ha'iri Yazdi, Ridwanullah Ta'ala, who was settled in Karbala. And he was sent by Imam Hussein to come to Qom. And he settled the Elmiye Seminary of Qom. At that time, it was very small seminary. And nowadays, more than 40 students in all levels, they are studying.
40,000 students.
40,000 students in all levels. Okay? They are studying, researching, and talking about Islamic, particularly Al-Mustafa International University, which is collecting students from all over the world.
And I think we shouldn't forget this, you know. It's like, it's not for no reason that the shrine has become, that this city has become the center for Islamic studies, for it's a scholastic center, it's an academic center, because Lady Fatima Masuma herself was an academic figure.
Exactly.
So the last story that I want to share with our dear listeners is that once this group of people come to Imam Musa ibn Ja'far alayhi salam, the father of Lady Fatima Masuma, and they bring with them a letter which contains the several questions that they had come across in the years, and they wanted to ask this from the imam. So the imam was actually not present in town, but the servant of the house, or the server of the house, gives this letter and takes it inside to Lady Fatima Masuma. So she takes the letter and she writes down the answers of those questions. On the way back, this caravan meets Imam Musa ibn Ja'far, and they say, yeah, we came to see you, and we had so many questions, and these are the answers that we got from your house. And the imam, when he opens the letter, he says, Fidaha Abuha, may her father be sacrificed for her, because this is the level.
Exactly the right answers.
And
exactly.
Exactly. So this is exactly how I would have answered as an imam. So this is why Qom is now the heart of the Shiite center of the world of Islam. It's because in Islam we are blessed to have a lady like Lady Fatima Masuma, who is herself an academic, shining academic figure. Thank you very much, Dr. Shamli. I'm going to say goodbye to you now. I would like to appreciate you for your time. Once again, I would like to express my sincere condolences on the occasion of the demise of Lady Fatima Masuma. We hope to see you in our next shows, inshallah, very soon.
Thank you very much.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back. Thank you very much for joining us on today's program of the Ship of Salvation. This was a special program on the occasion of the demise of Lady Fatima Masuma, Salamullah Alayha. I would like to add that according to some narrations, Lady Fatima Masuma is known to have been martyred because a lady from the city that she was living in at the time and the last days of her life poisoned her food, and thus she became a martyr. I hope that inshallah we will be the true followers of the path of the Ahlul Bayt, inshallah, and that Lady Fatima Masuma will shower us with her blessing and her knowledge and her presence spiritually and physically in our lives, inshallah, and that I hope that you from around the world will soon have the honor of visiting her beautiful shrine very soon, inshallah. Until another episode of The Ship of Salvation, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
European News Bulletin.
I'm Saeed Puruza. An inquest into the controversial drowning of a Muslim school girl in the north of England has resumed. 12-year-old Shukri Abdi drowned in a river in Bury, Greater Manchester, in June 2019. It is alleged she was told by a child who was with her shortly before her death, "If you don't get into the water, I'm going to kill you." Campaigners have accused the authorities of not investigating the case properly because of institutional racism and Islamophobia. The case has become very prominent after it was highlighted by the Black Lives Matter movement and a number of black celebrities. Well, our correspondent Roshan Mohammed Saleh attended the court proceedings in Rochdale today, and here is his update.
So the inquest into the tragic drowning of 12-year-old Shukri Abdi has finally resumed after a nine-month delay caused by the COVID pandemic. Now, before lockdown, we heard harrowing testimony of how Shukri was coerced and threatened and bullied into the water before she drowned. Now, today, we've been hearing evidence from the child, who we can't name for legal reasons, who's accused of doing that bullying, threatening and coercing. And that child, who I'm going to call they said that they were friends with Shukri and that they tried their best to prevent her from drowning, but they couldn't. Now, this inquest is due to last for another 2 days, and we're going to hear more evidence from eyewitnesses. And after it finishes, the family is hoping for some closure at last. It's been an agonizing wait for the last 9 months for the family. As for the campaigners who have accused the authorities of institutional racism and Islamophobia, well, I guess they're hoping for the possibility of just saying that this case was finally investigated properly. Roshan Mohammed Saleh, Rochdale.
Mohsen Abbas is a political commentator joining me now with his perspective on that story. Good to have you with us, Mohsen. So without saying too much about the inquest proceedings, what do the broad strokes of this case tell us about how new arrivals to this country can be treated?
Well, I think the first thing is that there's a fallacy that Britain is great with the refugees sort of and asylum seekers. The fact is that over half of the people seeking asylum wait longer than 6 months for a decision. So traumatized people who are vulnerable are treated like this in the first place. They get about £5.66 a day and struggle to survive because they're banned from working. And again, vulnerable people rescued supposedly from war zones and other disrupted regions, usually by Western imperialism's kind of interventions. So let me hasten to add, Somalia being one of them. So, of course, first of all, you've got the context of these folk who are actually, supplemented with further, if you like, torture and violence, psychological torture at least. And add to this then the importance of this case in the sense of the issues of institutional Islamophobia, the environment of fear and hate that's been generated by Western media and the authorities themselves. And you also think about the bullying that goes on in these schools, and add to this the hasty conclusions initially of the police force, the whitewashing by the school itself, and you start seeing how, if you like, a culture of Islamophobia and hatred is actually affecting real lives of people who are already vulnerable, if you like.
Right. Speaking of that environment of fear and hate that you just mentioned, some of that happening online, some of the reactions to Shukri's mother, Zamzam, pressing for the truth of what happened to her child caused a social media storm, with some saying if she didn't like the handling of the case by the authorities, she could pack up and leave the country. Very disheartening.
Well, I think more than disheartening, it's a sign of the kind of attitude in certain sectors of British society, which has now become the norm. Let's not underestimate the post 9/11 environment of hate and fear and how it's gripped certain communities, and that's all demonstrated within the rise of the right wing here and across Europe. It's demonstrated in, of course, Islamophobic hate crime, which is, you know, going through the roof. And the response of the authorities to such things, in this case, is a kind of, I think it's significant. It signifies that there's a failure in the system. And I think what Ashley Underwood, the QC, has said is, in this case, is that essentially the lowest verdict expectation of the family is gross negligence or manslaughter, and they don't even rule out a verdict of murder. This is what they want. I mean, and this would be unthinkable given the actions of the institutions, the school itself and the police, had they not been pushed into this by this extraordinary grassroots campaign. So I think that justice and equality are at stake here. And certainly, if nothing else, this case has highlighted the fact that there is institutional racism, institutional Islamophobia, which is affecting real lives.
That the petition that gathered nearly a million signatures, all the emails that were sent to Andy Murray, the mayor of Greater Manchester, did definitely play a role in the resumption of the inquest. Mohsen Abbas, thank you very much. All right, the parents of a 19-year-old Briton killed in a road accident in 2019 have lost their court battle with the British government over the diplomatic immunity of the wife of a U.S. official responsible for the collision. Harry Dunn's family have said Anne Sakoulis was driving on the wrong side of the road when she crashed with the teenager who was riding a motorbike near an Air Force base used by the U.S. military. Sakoulis left Britain shortly after the accident. Her lawyer says she'll not return voluntarily to potentially face jail for a, quote, terrible but unintentional accident. She was charged with causing death by dangerous driving in December, but an extradition request was denied the following month. European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen has said the coming days will be decisive as the 27-member bloc seeks to clinch a trade deal with Britain after its departure from the European Union.
The European Union is well prepared for a no-deal scenario, but of course we prefer to have an agreement. I fully trust in the skillful steer of our chief negotiator, Michel Barnier. But one thing is clear. Whatever the outcome, there has to be and there will be a clear difference between being a full member of the Union and being just a valued partner.
All sides indicate they want a deal, but significant areas of disagreement persist. Rules over issues such as fair competition and fisheries have blocked progress for a number of months now. If no agreement is reached by December 31st, the two sides will trade according to the default rules set by the Geneva-based World Trade Organization, a scenario that'll carry a significant financial impact. British Chancellor Rishi Sunak has announced he will borrow almost £400 billion this year to pay for the massive coronavirus hit to the UK's economy. The UK's economy is now set to shrink by more than 11% by the end of the year, its largest contraction since the early 1700s.
Our economic output is not expected to return to pre-crisis levels until the fourth quarter of 2022. And the economic damage is likely to be lasting. Long-term scarring means in 2025, the economy will be around 3% smaller than expected in the March budget.
With that announcement by the Chancellor, puts greater focus on the need to secure a trade deal with the European Union, as we have been reporting, but time to agree a deal is fast running out. Now, another four migrants have drowned off the Spanish coast, trying to reach the shores of Europe. Dozens were rescued, some remain unaccounted for. The International Criminal Court has sued Europe, saying it allows deaths at sea as part of its deterrence-based migration policy. The bloc is trying to prevent migrants from setting out and reaching its shores, but it seems desperation is so acute, migrants are prepared to risk dying at sea and face heartbreaking conditions if they make it ashore.
Arrivals on the Canary Islands have surged. Almost 17,000 people have reached their shores so far this year, more than 10 times last year's total, and hundreds have died trying. The Spanish government has promised to set up camps and shelters for more than 7,000 people, but overwhelmed local authorities and activists say the migrants are being treated with contempt.
The majority of migrants who are arriving are returnable, or expellable, if we may say. They are not candidates that apply to our reception system. Our reception system is tailored for vulnerable people and people who have asked for international asylum.
Over in France, images of homeless migrants camped out on a Paris square being evacuated by police have caused outcry, forcing lawmakers to comment on the situation that seems far from under control.
Cette manifestation était-elle autorisée?
Was this event authorized? Was it legal? The answer is no. Should we have left on the Place de la République hundreds of tents, hundreds of people without evacuating them? The answer is no. Was I, like you or others, shocked to see some images on social media of evacuation? Proof that this is a free country? Of course.
Ceux qui n'ont rien, pas même un toit.
Those who have nothing, not even a roof over their heads, sheltered themselves symbolically under the statue symbolizing the Republic to call for fundamental rights. They were peaceful. The order was given for them to be evacuated at any cost, although they did not represent any threat at all.
Immigration to Europe is fueled by wars and economic instability in which Europe is complicit. The bloc's exploitation of resources and interventionism goes on around the globe, and countries like Britain sell arms to almost all regimes deemed violators of human rights. To stop migrants setting out in the first place, millions of euros are also pumped into countries like Libya, a conduit for African migrants, and end up in the hands of militiamen, traffickers and Coast Guard members who imprison and torture thousands of migrants. Bianca Rahimi, London.
The French Parliament has passed a controversial bill making it illegal to share images of law enforcement online for malicious purposes. It's called the Global Security Bill, introduced by two MPs from President Emmanuel Macron's centrist party. Its most controversial section, Article 24, has been censured by journalists and rights groups, who argue it infringes on journalists' freedom to report on public events and that it makes it harder to hold officers accountable. The offense would carry a prison sentence of up to 1 year and a maximum fine of 45,000 euros. Thousands of protesters took to the streets across the country over the weekend to denounce the new law. The bill will go to the French Senate in January for a second approval. The Russian Defense Ministry has released a video showing the country's peacekeepers securing a passage of vehicles in Nagorno-Karabakh's Lachin Corridor, a six-kilometer road connecting the region's territories populated by ethnic Armenians and Armenia. It also says it has set up 23 observation posts within the region and helped in the transport of food and medicine to the local towns and villages. Armenia and Azerbaijan fought a six-week bloody war over Nagorno-Karabakh starting on September 27th. The enclave is internationally recognized as part of Azerbaijan, but has a majority ethnic Armenian population. We kick this segment off with some breaking news. The Argentinian football icon Diego Maradona has passed away after a heart attack. And Ahmed Caballo joins me now to tell us what he knows about that legend. Ahmed?
Yeah, so the news has just come through, shocked many football fans around the world who remember Diego Maradona for his brilliant attributes and the way he played the beautiful game. The stuff that he did for Argentina, he won the World Cup, many people claim single-handedly. He took Napoli, a team in relegation, and won Serie A twice. But he's actually linked to our next story. Our next story is about military overseas bases networks around the world. And Diego Maradona was an anti-imperialist. He opposed Britain's war on the Falklands. And when he did his controversial Hand of God and was criticised in the British press, he said it was symbolic revenge for the war crimes by the Thatcher government at the time. He supported Fidel Castro, and he's actually died on the same day that Fidel Castro died a few years ago. And he also supported Venezuela when it was attacked by the United States and defended its right, its constitutionally elected president, Nicolas Maduro, and its constitutionally elected president before him, Hugo Chavez. So he
never left the public eye, so to speak, decades after he retired.
No, because he represented what somebody from the slums, somebody who would be considered a on the outskirts of Argentinian society, and he made himself what many people argue is the greatest football player of all time. He could juggle with tomatoes, with oranges. He had immense skill, and he played the game as if it was just fun and not as if it was a job. And many people will miss him, and many people are upset. It's one of the number one trending topics because of exactly what he did on a football pitch. But many people in Latin America also respect what he did off the football pitch and the politics that he represented, the downtrodden, the forgotten, the oppressed. He was always willing to stand up for them in the face of U.S. empire.
All right, more, of course, on the Argentine football legend in our broadcasts later today, Ahmed. But let's move on to your other story. This past week, the UK government announced its largest military investment since the Cold War, despite the coronavirus crisis battering the country's economy. Since then, a report by Declassified UK on the extent of the kingdom's global military presence. Give us the lowdown on that, Ahmed.
Yeah, so there's 145 sites in 42 countries, and it's extraordinary the scale of the UK's military overseas operations. And it has military bases in Oman, in Cyprus, the military base is used to refuel military special force operations in places like Syria. It has military bases in Iraq, despite the Iraqi parliament in January voting for all foreign troops to leave the country. And what's fascinating about this is whenever there were human rights abuses or some sort of massacre in these countries, there are still people from around the world that ask the UK to speak out. But when you look at this report by Declassified, it shows that the UK actually props up these regimes and supports them in suppressing their populations and their civilians. So in Oman, where it's a criminal offence to criticise the Sultan, Britain has military bases and provides training for the Oman special forces and the military forces. In Saudi Arabia, it provides support. It provides support in Bahrain in the repression against protesters there. And controversially, it supports the Saudi-led war on Yemen by
exactly.
overseeing
and that, Ahmed, speaks to the hypocrisy of this government, because on one hand, they're sending a lot of aid to Yemen. They're a major, if not the major contributor of aid to Yemen. At the same time, the RAF is training pilots in Saudi to bomb those same Yemeni people, 25 million of whom, out of a population of 30 million, are facing food security, which is, in fact, a euphemism for famine.
Yeah, and it's our job to point out that hypocrisy. So the amount that they give in humanitarian aid is just a drop in the ocean compared to the billions upon billions that they make from selling the Saudis, the United Arab Emirates, arms to bomb children, hospitals, and civilian infrastructure. And one of the people that's opposing this is Chris Williamson. He was a member of parliament for the Labour Party. He was kicked out for the Labour Party, and we can see why, because he was willing to speak out on things like this. He says, why on earth has the UK still got military bases overseas? An investigation by Declassified UK has revealed there are 145 of them in 42 countries. This isn't serving the national interest. It's an outrageous example of modern-day imperialism. And Jaber says this, UK forces have 23 bases and personnel in Saudi Arabia, Iraq, Jordan, Persian Gulf states, and the US embassy in Jerusalem, Al-Quds. More controversial is Britain's major military base in the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, in Riyadh. Armed forces are present in bases where RAF officers observe Saudi-led coalition air ops in Yemen.
All right, Ahmed, let's move on to your second story. And more on the clandestine meeting between the Israeli Prime Minister and the Saudi Crown Prince, known as MBS, and their so-called tactical alliance, which, looking at the story, has evidently got more to do with Iran than anything else, the thought of a Biden administration taking the United States back to the JCPOA, which is known as the 2015 Iran nuclear deal, Ahmed.
Yeah, I mean, what's interesting about this story is the Israelis initially tweeted that there was a secret meeting, and then that tweet was deleted, and now Netanyahu has refused to acknowledge that this secret meeting had taken place. The Saudis have completely refused to acknowledge it. But it clearly did, and it happens at a time for two strategically important reasons for both of these entities. For the Saudis, it's very clear that Joe Biden administration is going to be a lot more hostile towards them than the Donald Trump administration. Joe Biden has been very critical of the assassination of the Saudi dissident journalist Jamal Khashoggi. He's also criticized the Saudi-led war on Yemen. Now, obviously, this is rhetoric. Whether he'll do anything in practice remains to be seen. And the Israelis clearly want to carry on with this attempt to get all these Arab regimes to normalize relations with Israel, and therefore forcing the Palestinians' hands, because all of their neighbors around them would have capitulated. But what's interesting about this story is we're finding out that the Saudis have been putting pressure on Pakistan, much like they've been putting pressure on Sudan. And it seems like the end game for the Saudi regime is, if it forces the other Arab nations to normalize relations with Israel first, then it can normalize relations, and its defense can be, well, we weren't the first, we were the last ones to do it. But it's clear they're the ones pulling the strings for these Muslim majority nations to normalize relations with Israel.
Right. How has this story gone down on social media, Ahmed?
Yes, yeah, so I'm going to go to a tweet, then I'm going to go to a VT. So I've got a tweet from Paxul. It says, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu secretly visited Saudi Arabia, MBS, and has again proved that the Saudi dictator regime want to survive in power at any cost. There's much more to come. May Allah save us from the destruction that is going on towards the Muslim.
If we didn't have Saudi Arabia, we wouldn't have a big base. We wouldn't have any reason, probably. I mean, if you look at Israel, Israel would be in big trouble without Saudi Arabia. So what does that mean? Israel's going to leave? You want Israel to leave? We have a very strong ally in Saudi Arabia.
But any more reaction to that story?
Yes. So Ben Norton says, the UK, US government, and the authoritarian proxy dictatorship pops up in Saudi Arabia, is going around to every Muslim majority country and trying to bribe and threaten them to recognize apartheid Israel. Pakistan is the latest example. Not everyone agrees. We've got a Trump supporter, Prashant Patel. He says, Trump made Israeli-Saudi peace deal possible. Trump unraveled conflict with North Korea. Trump is the only US president who didn't start any war in the last 30 years. Still, Trump is hated by the far left. Now, I don't call it a peace deal. It's more like an anti-Iran war alliance. These countries have never, or these entities have never been a threat to one another. So it's not really a peace deal.
All right. Ahmed Caballo with those three stories. Ahmed, thank you very much. And that's all the time we have for this London broadcast, everyone. Thank you for tuning in, and we'll see you again soon.
English Radio. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
According to AirWires, a UK-based non-profit organization that works to track and assess military actions in conflict zones, the new data has allowed for the accurate locating of just 341 incidents of civilian harm and roughly 1,400 civilian deaths from 2014 to 2019 that have been acknowledged by the U.S. military. Air Wars estimates that the total number of civilians killed by U.S.-led coalition forces during the war is somewhere in the range of 8,310 to 13,187. It's more than that. A new mechanism should also be set up to receive and assess any future war crimes these forces may commit in Afghanistan, Iraq, and Syria. It's only a way to prevent similar future incidents and ensure justice for the victims. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by the staff of Fars News Agency, which is published under the heading, Time to Charge U.S. and Allies with War Crimes. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. The U.S. military has for the first time published the geographic coordinates for nearly all confirmed instances of civilian harm and deaths in Iraq and Syria, although true numbers are way beyond those confirmed by the Pentagon. According to Air Wars, a UK-based non-profit organization that works to track and assess military actions in conflict zones, the new data has allowed for the accurate locating of just 341 incidents of civilian harm and roughly 1,400 civilian deaths from 2014 and 2019 that have been acknowledged by the U.S. military. Air Wars estimates that the total number of civilians killed by U.S.-led coalition forces during the war is somewhere where in the range of 8,310 to 13,187, and it's more than that. Millions of people have been affected by the twin wars, and it's an underestimation to say that just about 10,000 or so were killed. In addition, what about those who have died of hunger and disease? What about those who killed by America's moderate terrorists? The breakthrough should provide insight into questions that have been looming for years. The data shows when and where a particular event took place and simplifies the process of determining which individuals were affected by a specific attack. This new evidence should open the door for formal apologies and restitution payments from the United States and its allies. Mind you, this is not just about civilians who lost their lives in Iraq and Syria. The U.S. and its allies killed many civilians in Afghanistan as well. And we haven't even started talking about the innocent people killed in Yemen. They also need transparency, formal apologies, and restitution payments. They also want all U.S.-led troops out of their countries. With the release of more specific geographic data, more claims should be filed in Yemen and Afghanistan. And this should include America's allies. For instance, even Australia has admitted that its special forces are responsible for unlawful killings of civilians in Afghanistan. It has just released a long-awaited report into war crimes committed in South Asian nation. The inquiry came amid reports from whistleblowers and in the local media of the killing of unarmed men and children that Australia initially tried to suppress. According to General Angus Campbell, Chief of the Defense Force, members of the Australian Special Forces killed prisoners, farmers, or other civilians. he has offered his unreserved apologies to the people of Afghanistan for the wrongdoing. These findings about the most serious breaches of military conduct and professional values should be enough to charge the U.S. and its allies with war crimes and crimes committed against humanity in Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, and Yemen. They have all been involved in the unlawful killing of civilians and prisoners, and this is never acceptable at the International Criminal Court in The Hague. What's horrifying is that many of those responsible are still serving in the U.S.-led military alliance. As we speak, they could easily kill more civilians and no one would ever notice. This is important because none of these crimes was committed during the heat of battle. The victims were all non-combatants, and to justify their killing, the U.S.-led forces planted weapons on some of them, while junior soldiers were forced to shoot prisoners for a first kill as part of an initiation known as blooding. As things stand, it would be impossible to uncover all wrongdoing that have taken place during the U.S.-led wars, but it's still possible to investigate those that these militaries have themselves admitted under investigation. A new mechanism should also be set up to receive and assess any future war crimes these forces may commit in Afghanistan, Iraq, and Syria. It's the only way to prevent similar future incidents and ensure justice for the victims.
This is A to Z. An introduction to Islamic lifestyle. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Most Beneficent, the Most Merciful. Dear brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum. Peace and blessings of Allah be upon you all. This is A to Z, coming to you from IRIB English Radio, and I'm your host, Ali. This radio show is about Islamic lifestyle, and in each episode, we will be talking about a different lesson. Please stay with us till the end of today's program. Today's lesson, self-examination. Brothers and sisters, we all know that a human being is a composition of a body and soul. We have a physical body, we have a physical existence, and then we have a soul, which is our spiritual existence, or you can call it our metaphysical existence. Now, when it comes to self-examination yourself, you of course want to examine your physical existence and watch out for your physical well-being, but more importantly, you need to keep a very close eye on your spiritual existence. The spiritual existence is what requires a continuous and a robust examination because it's a very fine line to be spiritually healthy. Now, some of the questions, you know, we want to give to you as a starter, you know, something that would get you going. You would start thinking about self-examination and how to perform it. Ask yourself, for instance, am I spiritually awake and catering to the needs of my soul? Just our physical existence, our soul has also needs. Are we fulfilling those needs? The second question you can ask yourself is, today,
the very day I'm living in, right now, have I gotten nearer to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, for instance, in times of prayers, or have I given in to laziness? Have I been lazy in performing my responsibilities and hence getting away and farther from Allah? This is a question you can ask yourself anytime while driving, while reading, you know, while going to bed, while brushing your teeth. Well, another question, again, to help you out is, today, has my faith been weakened by negligence or strengthened due to vigilance? Last but not the least, have I felt the presence of God, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, while making decisions in today? So these are some starters that will give you a thought process that will enable and help you to examine yourself. Welcome back to your listeners. We've been talking about self-examination, and that is not a physical exam that we're talking about. Of course, that's important in its own place, but today we're discussing the spiritual examination of oneself. We have brought to you a few questions before the break, which will enable and help you to examine yourself in an effective and a productive manner. Let's go over a few more thoughts before we conclude this episode. Another question is, have I made a productive use of my time, or have I been wasting my time on unnecessary activities? Another question, have I been extravagant and excessive in spending, or have I used my time, money, energies, and resources wisely? When we say wisely, it means really based on the instructions of Quran, Prophet, and Ahlul Bayt. And the last question for today's program is, have I governed my tongue, eyes, and other body parts today? So if you're vigilant, if you're asking these right questions to yourself, rest assured it's going to help you grow spiritually and maintain your spiritual health in the way it is supposed to be taken care of. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, thank you very much for staying with us till the end of today's episode of A to Z. Don't forget to log on to our website at www.parsetoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you all in the care of Allah. Till next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 49 meters, 7300 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.